This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, we just returned from the annual gathering of the nation's community health center organizations. The National Association of Community Health Centers represents thousands of care delivery organizations which serve the health needs of some 25 million Americans. It was an energized gathering this year as healthcare providers come together to share best practices, but also to brace themselves for some of the challenges that lie ahead.
Well, Mark, it is always so great to connect with our colleagues from around the country who are doing such great work on the front lines of providing primary care to the nation's underserved and vulnerable populations. But boy, you're right, there's so much concern about what's to come next from a health policy perspective. While the GOP health plan failed to get off the ground, there's still so much uncertainty about what is likely to happen next. And that's very challenging for people.
And looming over all of us is the president's budget cuts to a significant chunk of money from the Department of Health and Human Services. And HHS Secretary Tom Price has indicated that he will seek to roll back Medicaid expansion across the country, which could significantly impact the nation's community health centers, which provide care to a large sector of the Medicaid population. And let's not forget, community health centers have also proven to be terrific incubators for innovation in care delivery models and population health management.
Well, that is something that our guest today is keeping a close eye on, Mark. Dr. Joshua Seidman is the Senior VP of Payment and Delivery Innovation at Avalere Health. But of note, he served as the Director of Meaningful Use at the Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT and certainly understands the importance of forward motion towards value-based care delivery models that can really improve population health and create some economies in our system. So we're looking forward to hearing from him.
And we're also looking forward to hearing from Lori Robertson, the Managing Editor of FactCheck.org, looks for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter because we love to hear from you. Now we'll get to our interview with Josh Seidman in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Setback for one state that had sought to expand Medicaid for more residents living close to the poverty line, Kansas lawmakers failed to produce enough votes to override Governor Brownback's veto of the Medicaid expansion, which would have provided health coverage to 180,000 uninsured residents. Governor Brownback has been a staunch opponent of government spending and viewed the Medicaid expansion as too costly for the state, which has seen significant budget shortfalls in the wake of Governor Brownback's revenue-cutting approach, although the Medicaid expansion is largely covered by the federal government for the initial few years of expansion. The veto override fell 3 votes short. Meanwhile, those who receive subsidies to help underwrite the cost of purchasing health insurance on the online exchanges are concerned about the outcome of a case launched by House Republicans. They sued the Obama administration last year, challenging the legality of the subsidies, saying the funds were not appropriated by Congress. House Speaker Paul Ryan says they're continuing ahead with a lawsuit, but says they won't halt the subsidies while awaiting the outcome of the suit. Meanwhile, Congressman Greg Walden, a Republican from Oregon and chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, vowed to protect those subsidies at least for the rest of 2017. President Trump took his health care diplomacy approach to the links, inviting Libertarian Senator Rand Paul to Mar-a-Lago for some golf and conversation over health care. Members of the Republican Freedom Caucus were vehemently opposed to the GOP health care proposal, the American Health Care Act, saying it didn't go far enough to eliminate provisions of Obamacare. Trump publicly vilified the Freedom Caucus on Twitter, saying if they refused to negotiate, the president would, quote, make a deal with the Democrats. While the president has said he's moved on after the defeat of the AHCA, he's still carrying on talks with a new approach. In the wake of the anti-vaccination movement, some once-thwarted childhood infections have made quite a comeback. Measles outbreaks have risen steadily in recent years, and whooping cough, once a scourge of the 19th century, has become a persistent foe once again, targeting small babies especially. Now a study finds pregnant women given a pertussis vaccine have babies who are far less likely to contract the virulent respiratory illness that can be deadly in many cases. Researchers at California's Kaiser Permanente examined data on almost 149,000 infants born in California between 2010 and 2015. They found babies whose mothers got the Tdap booster vaccine for tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis were 91% less likely to get whooping cough during the first 2 months of life, a critical period before U.S. infants typically get their first dose of the vaccine. Health officials in many countries recommend vaccination during pregnancy, as well as a series of three shots for infants starting sometime between 6 weeks and 3 months of age. Some countries also recommend women get vaccinated during each pregnancy because effectiveness of the shot wanes over time. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Joshua J. Seidman, Ph.D., Senior Vice President of Payment and Delivery Innovation at Avalere Health, a Washington, D.C.-based consulting firm dedicated to solving challenges in the healthcare system. Dr. Seidman also served as Director of Meaningful Use at the Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT at the Department of Health and Human Services. He's the founding president of the Center for Information Therapy, which tailored direct-to-consumer information to improve health behaviors. He also worked for the National Committee for Quality Assurance as the Director of Measure Development. He earned his bachelor's degree in political science from Brown University and master's and PhD in health service research from Johns Hopkins University. Josh, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Good to be with you.
Yeah. And so you are somebody who is very familiar with Washington and also health policy, and I'm sure you've been quite busy in recent days with the GOP version of health reform, the American Health Care Act failing to make it through even the House. And it feels like we are left with more questions than answers. And while President Trump and House Speaker Ryan have said they're moving on to other issues, there's much talk on the Hill of another attempt at health reform of some kind. And I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners your sense of what the GOP reform efforts might be, and were you surprised by the swift derailment of the legislation?
I think everybody was a little surprised at how tough it was in the House. That certainly seemed to be the much easier place to get things done for the current Congress. It was not a surprise to me that they had a lot of challenges in actually implementing something or actually agreeing on legislation. It's much harder to actually craft legislation than to critique legislation. Once a law is established and embedded into how healthcare is done in the country, it becomes very difficult to take things away from people. And of course, there would have been, CBO said, 24 million people who would have lost health insurance over the next decade. And you know, that becomes an issue for members of Congress who are trying to get reelected by those who might be losing coverage. When the CBO score came out with those numbers, it definitely reinforced in a very real way for members of Congress what they were facing. And then, of course, there is the polarization even within the party, the Republican Party right now, over how far to go, which, of course, played out between the Freedom Caucus and the rest of the party.
Well, Josh, while the Affordable Care Act, I think we would certainly agree, has some flaws and elements that need improvement, there really isn't a lot of doubt that it's done an enormous amount to expand coverage and also to positively impact population health in this country. But still, we have this very entrenched disconnect between the two competing political parties on what health reform should look like. But we've really paid attention to this kind of slowly rising chorus of Republican policymakers like Senator Susan Collins of Maine and Republican governors like John Kasich of Ohio, who are calling for a more bipartisan approach to reform. Give us your forecast. What's the likelihood we'll see some kind of bipartisan solutions coming forward in the wake of the failure to pass the American Health Care Act?
I think it's actually going to be very difficult to do that. First of all, it is a very polarized environment, and until very recently, there haven't really been any efforts at moving in any bipartisan way to find solutions to some of the issues that do exist. I think that, as I said, it's just very complicated to do this kind of thing, and it becomes a question of how you're going to change things that, for a lot of people are working reasonably well. They're going to have to make some decisions about how much time and how much political capital to spend on this one issue. Obviously, there are a lot of things that the Congress and the new administration want to accomplish, and they are beginning to realize how time-intensive and resource-intensive it's going to be to get things done on any kind of changes to the ACA.
So we're really left to the powers that were written into the ACA for the Secretary Tom Price, who seems pretty determined to make changes in the Medicaid program as well as other population health initiatives. I'm wondering if you could talk about some likely scenarios for changes to the Affordable Care Act and what aspects of the health law do you view as vulnerable?
Yeah, there are certain things that they, in a sense, have already begun. You know, we saw in the last open enrollment period that they really pulled back on a lot of the active efforts to try to get people signed up. And there's now actually some inspector general looking at what went on there. You know, I think one could expect that to the extent that they have said that they are looking for ways to see it explode and things like that, that you might see those kinds of things continue. But beyond that, there is certainly the issue of the subsidies right now, where there is a lawsuit that the House had filed against the administration, and it is going to be very interesting to see what happens there, because the subsidies obviously are a huge part of the success of getting people signed up along with the Medicaid expansion. And so without the subsidies, that would potentially unravel a lot of the coverage in the marketplaces. You mentioned Medicaid. I think it's pretty clear that both the current Secretary Price, as well as the new CMS Administrator, Seema Verma, have a lot of interest in using Medicaid to experiment with a number of things. And Seema Verma, in particular, has a lot of experience in implementing new approaches to how to manage Medicaid. So I think we're going to see this administration approve a lot of Medicaid waivers, and those could, you know, test out a lot of the things that they wanted to do with the AHCA, per capita caps or block grants. I think we'll see them pushing some of the limits there.
Well, Josh, I'm going to let us take a breath from the AHCA for just a moment and ask you about some of your time at the Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT, where you were tasked with advancing what we came to know as the meaningful use of health information technology. Certainly that first big grand challenge, which was to shift the health industry from paper to electronic health records, I think was well executed on. But the requirement to use that technology to really improve care has been a harder lift. Talk with us about your experiences advancing the meaningful use throughout the industry and the progress that's been made.
Yeah, there's no doubt that the transition to digitization of health records has been mostly accomplished. So, you know, we saw for decades that every year people would say, well, you know, within the next 5 years we'll be digital. You know, it just didn't happen until, of course, 2009, when the stimulus bill, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, passed, and the high-tech part of that actually did stimulate through incentives the digitization, where, you know, it was less than 10% of hospitals in 2009, and now more than 90% of hospitals are electronic. You know, that bill did focus not just on digitization, but as you said, on the meaningful use of EHRs. And we were very concerned at the time that just focusing on moving to electronic might just make the same bad processes happen faster. And I would say that we have, you know, achieved pieces of that, but we still have a long way to go. The HITECH Act was constructed with a series of carrots and sticks. And of course, all those carrots were the tens of billions of dollars of incentive payments to providers. And those, of course, are now all gone. And what's left really are the sticks. I think that we are in a place where there is this real challenge and this balancing act, certainly that we faced when we implemented, you know, from the beginning, stage one meaningful use, all the way to the present, which is that we wanted to provide enough direction and enough specificity that people were driven to meaningfully use by doing more than just a check-the-box activity, but on the other hand, trying not to be overly prescriptive. And that balancing act is, you know, one of the most challenging things of either writing legislation or implementing regulation. And I think that that is still, you know, still a challenge that is being faced. We, I think, are in a place that if we can continue to build on the progress, we have a lot of the infrastructure now to make it possible.
We're speaking today with Joshua J. Seidman, Ph.D., Senior Vice President of Payment and Delivery Innovation at Avalere Health. Dr. Seidman also served as Director of Meaningful Use at the Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT at the Department of Health and Human Services. Josh, you know, changes in administration always bring policy uncertainty, and we still need to focus in on what will move the healthcare system forward. And your work at Avalere Health is specifically focused on innovations in payment and care delivery, really trying to move the country from volume to value. But the table for that was really set with the passage of MACRA, and that's the Medicare Reimbursement and CHIP Reauthorization Act. A recent study found that 20% of smaller physician practices are ready to meet the MACRA requirements. But with so much uncertainty around policy directives, what kind of forces do you see moving these policy initiatives forward, and how should the healthcare stakeholders be preparing for MACRA?
We definitely, I think, are in a place where we have set in motion this movement from fee-for-service, basically a place where we historically have paid providers for doing things to people, now trying to think about how we actually pay for helping people to be healthier. And I think that we are very much in a transition, and it's something that's going on in both the public and the private sector. Certainly, the ACA helped to stimulate a lot of that as well, but it is something that is now very much embedded both publicly and privately in the healthcare system. So MACRA certainly is reshaping how physicians will be paid under Medicare, but there clearly is a long way to go for them to be prepared, as you say. It also is, again, a question of this balancing act of making sure that they are accountable for more than just check-the-box activity, but also trying to make sure that the measures that we're using to assess whether we're getting value actually do measure things that matter to patients. And I think that that is a big challenge. But I think it's also important to keep in mind this was a bipartisan bill, one of the very few healthcare bills passed on a bipartisan basis. And, you know, we can expect to see continuation of the basic tenets of it, whether the new administration tinkers to create more flexibility for physicians, I think is something that we will be watching, because there are other levers in ACA that they can use. And, you know, there is the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, which has been testing out new payment and delivery models. But there may be, again, some tweaks. One of the things that the Secretary has been critical of in the past is mandatory bundled payments. The last administration has put in place for comprehensive joint replacement, and which is already in place, and then a final rule was finalized at the end of the last administration on some cardiac bundles and hip and femur fractures. And those bundled payments are mandatory for a fifth to a quarter of all hospitals. It is now something that I think is a little bit in question as to whether that will continue to move forward. If it does not, it means that those hospitals that have been sitting on the sidelines would be able to continue sitting on the sidelines as the new kind of payment methodology moves forward.
I know you recently participated in a Politico panel with former White House Chief Technology Officer Anish Chopra and VA Secretary Dr. David Shulkin, both of whom I would note are former guests on the show. And, you know, it seems we heard so much about the VA and its need to grapple and with and address the wait time issue. But it's also important to remember that they've made very significant inroads in telehealth, as well as widespread use of data that's mined from their very longstanding electronic health records. So it seems like a lot to be learned from their experience as well.
they really have done a lot of important things that we can learn from. What they certainly did, I think, were probably three things. One is that, you know, very early on, they did make a commitment to electronic health information and figuring out ways to use that, and not just ways to digitize, but actually to do things to actually help veterans get better health care. So that, you know, that was the first, that commitment to VISTA early on means that they were really ahead of the curve in that respect. The second is that they applied that to their quality improvement efforts and, you know, demonstrated very high quality on a number of performance measures, certainly in areas like diabetes care and cardiovascular care. The VA has performed very well, and in part because they have made meaningful use out of some of those systems through VISTA. And then the third thing I would say is they made a commitment early on to engaging patients in the use of that technology. You know, they implemented something called My Healthy Vet, which was a personal health record or a PHR, a portal for patients to get into their records and to be able to engage electronically with their clinical teams. I think that is, you know, something that now is, we see it all over, but they were, again, definitely ahead of the curve, and that's something that we should be trying to replicate elsewhere. And similarly, they were one of the leaders in the federal government with the use of something called Blue Button, which allows for download of information, and over 1 million veterans have made use of that Blue Button to download their health information.
Speaking of great places, in your old stomping grounds, the Office of National Coordinator will have a new lead. Dr. Donald Rucker was just named to the position at HHS, a former medical director at Siemens, recently a professor of bioinformatics at Ohio State School of Medicine. Any thoughts on the appointment and what direction he's likely to take at ONC? And obviously, a lot of important dates coming up in terms of meaningful use and the like, and there's certainly a lot of political pressure to slow things down, but what are your thoughts?
I personally do not know Dr. Rucker. He is certainly someone who has a lot of respect and a lot of valuable experience, and that will certainly be important. I think that what confronts Dr. Rucker now is some of the challenges we were talking about before. There is this issue of not having a lot of carrots and trying to figure out how to use the sticks that do exist under MACRA and for the hospitals still under the Meaningful Use Program to continue to move forward, particularly around health information exchange, removing barriers to interoperability, removing, trying to crack down on any information blocking that's going on, things of that nature, and, you know, maintaining, you know, strong certification standards while trying to allow for flexibility. You know, you mentioned earlier one of the other changes that could happen from the current administration and healthcare is what they do on the budget. And if the current proposed budget from the administration, and it wasn't a full budget, it was a sort of a budget outline, were to move through, it would obviously constrict the funding for most agencies that are domestic programs that are not entitlements. And so, you know, that was one of the things that certainly was very helpful in advancing the cause of electronic health records, was having, you know, sufficient resources to be able to support providers and the industry in making that kind of progress. I think that it'll be interesting to see what happens with the budget and what kinds of resources Dr. Rucker has to move forward.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Joshua Seidman, Senior VP of Payment and Delivery Innovation at Avalere Health. You can learn more about his work by going to avalere.com, or you can follow him on Twitter at jseidman. Josh, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
You're welcome.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
In seeking to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price has said, quote, one out of every three physicians in this nation aren't seeing Medicaid patients. It's a common criticism of the Medicaid program that the doctor participation rate is lower than the rate for Medicare beneficiaries or the privately insured. We looked at why that is and what this means for patients. There are no continuous measures on Medicaid participation, but federal statistics gathered over recent years show that the percentage of physicians accepting new Medicaid patients has remained around 70%. We found no support for the idea that the rate has declined under the ACA. The participation rate varies by state. In 25 states, the rate was significantly higher than the nationwide figure of about 70%, and in 5 states, it was significantly lower. That variation largely reflects reimbursement rates. For example, Montana pays primary care doctors the same rate for Medicaid and Medicare and has a Medicaid doctor participation rate of 90%. And these reimbursement rates tend to reflect the degree to which states have expanded eligibility beyond federal requirements. If a state expands eligibility, it may have to cut the reimbursement rates to limit spending. While doctors who take no or only some new Medicaid patients overwhelmingly cited low payment as the reason in a nationally representative survey, 3/4 also cited delayed payment and billing requirements. What does this mean for access to care? Well, participation rates are limited measures of that. The supply of doctors and their geographic distribution are important factors. Access could be better in an area with a high supply of doctors but low participation compared with an area with few physicians but high participation rates. Studies show Medicaid beneficiaries fare as well as the privately insured on key measures of access to care. One analysis of federal survey data found that 74% of adults with Medicaid coverage had seen a doctor in the previous 12 months, while 69% with private insurance had done so. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Stanford-based bioengineer Manu Prakash has a simple goal. He wants to create a portable medical lab small enough to fit in a backpack, and he's already developed a tool that fits the bill. While sitting under a tree in Uganda, he noticed that the local medical clinic's door was propped open by an expensive centrifuge machine, one that was reliant on electricity, now broken and no longer in use. And he wondered, how could he create a portable centrifuge that would be inexpensive to make, easy to operate, and easy to replace? His inspiration came from a simple ancient childhood toy, the whirligig, a toy that functions by pulling two ends of a string threaded through a round object like a button.
Before us, nobody had actually understood how this toy works. So we spent a significant portion of this time truly understanding the mathematical phase space for how you can convert linear motion into rotational motion. And there's some beautiful mathematics hidden inside this object.
So he took this simple toy idea to another level, creating a human-powered centrifuge made from simple components. Paper, twine, and plastic. Altogether, each paperfuge, as he calls it, can be constructed in under 2 minutes and costs only 20 cents. And yet, remarkably, it works extremely efficiently.
With this set of principles, we're able to essentially make a centrifuge that spins all the way to 120,000 RPM. In the lab, we can separate and pull out malaria parasites from blood. We can separate filaria, African sleeping sickness, separate blood plasma. It is an ultra-low-cost centrifuge that's built out of principles of a very old toy.
Prakash and his team have already deployed the paperfuge to a couple of third-world clinical settings to start collecting data for wider deployment. It's currently being tested for malaria diagnoses, but is being readied for far more complex diagnostic challenges.
This is a tool that requires no electricity, no infrastructure. You can carry them around in your pockets for a price point of 20 cents.
The paperfuge. a cheap but highly effective field tool for clinicians, providing a portable solution to diagnostic challenges, creating a quicker pathway to diagnosis and treatment. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.